Today, for Cultural Icons, I will be interviewing Peter Scholes. Peter is a long-standing Auckland musician. He's a fine clarinetist. He's conductor of the Auckland Chamber Orchestra and has conducted many other orchestras as well. And he is a composer who has written music for film. He's written so-called pure music. He's written music for dance. He set words. Peter, was there always music in your family, or was there music in your family?
Yeah, I grew up in a household of a lot of things going on, and music was one of them. There wasn't any professional music happening, but my brothers played the guitar, and classical music was always being played on the LPs back then. And but I think the biggest influence in growing up was the fact that my dad was seriously into art, visual art, and in fact I opened one of the first dealer galleries in the country in Rotorua, Scholes Gallery. And so I was growing up, and he had Colin McCann exhibitions, Gretchen Albrecht. This is back in the 60s, early 60s, and I mean, I like to think that some of it kind of rubbed off, because looking back on it, it's just amazing the enterprise that my dad had to get to take the plunge in that regard and do that stuff.
And that was in Rotorua in the 60s?
That's right, yeah, Rotorua.
So did you grow up there?
Yeah, I grew up in Whakarewa, whatever, and when exploring the mud pools, would sometimes sort of go AWOL from home and at great panic moments with my parents as they race off down to try and find me, because it was kind of free access into the thermal area right. that in those years.
They would have lived in dread if you were being boiled.
Yeah, boiled Pākehā.
You say your brothers played instruments.
Yeah, my dad actually was a saxophone player in a dance band, but that was before coming out from to New Zealand. They came out in 1948, I think. But he used to play, there's a wonderful picture that I treasure of him holding an alto sax and in a suit and looking real dapper. And my mum played the piano. There's a piano in the house. And so music was there, but I didn't start getting involved in it until much later, early teens.
You didn't have a child prodigy sort of sense of vocation by the age of five about music?
Not at all. No, I was just kind of enjoying being a kid and playing with my friends. And yeah.
Where had your parents come from?
They came from England.
Right.
My mum was a Londoner and dad in Swindon, and and dad was an aircraft engineer during the war at de Havilland's. His team figured out how to rescue bent propellers when planes would come crash land, and how to resurrect and get the propellers going again. So they could be reused.
That would be pretty important in wartime.
Mm.
Was clarinet your first encounter with an instrument, or were there others?
It was. I do remember in my intermediate days a very failed attempt at classroom recorders, where the recorders would be dutifully taken off you after the session and rinsed out in sterilising liquid and put back in the cupboard until the next week. I remember the sterilisation process more than I remember the music. But it all started for me in the third form when I went to boarding school. And did some kind of musical aptitude test where they whistled a few notes at you and asked you whether it was higher or lower or something. And I passed quite well with that. And they suggested I learn an instrument. And so I called Dad and I said, "Hey, Dad, they want me to learn an instrument. What should I learn?" And my dad said, "Oh, why not the clarinet?" Because he played clarinet and saxophone. Mm. That was his kind of world. So sure enough, I started playing the clarinet and had a fabulous teacher, George Hopkins.
He was your first teacher?
He was my first teacher. Mm. I only had him for 1 year, but I can vividly remember the first lesson he gave me. And with he was sitting there, and we introduced ourselves. And I had in my mind the memory of a recording of Mozart's clarinet quintet that Mum and Dad used to play quite a lot. It was one of their favourite pieces. It's a piece for clarinet and string quartet. And I had the sound of that in my head, and I thought it was quite magical, you know, that lovely, pure, velvety clarinet tone. But for me, at that age, it just existed purely in the realm of the stereo and the record and this mystery of overseas recordings and stuff. And then I remember George Hopkins picking up his clarinet and just making a few notes. And I was hooked like that straight away, because here was this guy in the flesh making this same beautiful sound that I'd so come to love before that. So I practiced like crazy every day for 1 or 2 hours, and you know, that's without exception. Even when I went on holiday, camping trips, I took my clarinet with me everywhere. I may have driven the family nuts, but that was yeah, and you know, and then tragically, he died the next year, I think, because he died of cancer. My second year was with a different teacher, Anton Radaich. It was a completely different approach. Good teacher. He played in the professional orchestra at that stage.
Right. Was George Hopkins in the NZSO?
No, I don't. I'm not sure.
Mm.
I think he played in the Auckland. He was in the Auckland Orchestra.
Right.
I'm not sure of his.
Yeah, I keep thinking of him as having been an orchestral player, but I don't know why.
But there's a great legacy going through there, because George and Helen Hopkins, great musicians, and then their daughter Virginia, is a great cellist.
Of course.
And then her son Cameron, who is now also a vibrant and active cellist.
Right. Does a clarinetist tend to specialise in one, like bass or?
I think generally most clarinetists will play the whole family if they've got the chance. It's there's a kind of a fun factor and although the technique is different from one to the other, there's a lot of common ground, and so it's very very common for clarinetists to play the little wee E flat through to the bass clarinet. And in fact, Andrew, one of my students, who's now a fully established professional player, and he's even recently just bought himself a contrabass clarinet, which is an octave lower than a bass clarinet. And so it's all, you know, it's kind of clarinet heaven stuff. This.
Yes.
Yeah.
Your CV lists four teachers. Who was the latest choice, eh? Was it Ken Wilson?
My studies at Auckland University were with Ken Wilson.
Yeah.
And he was a very, very systematic, very thorough, no-nonsense teacher. Came from the American kind of school of pedagogy. And, so I worked with him for 3 years. And that's when I kind of learnt the trade, as it were, with him. He also gave me wonderful professional openings and opportunities with recording, doing Sunday morning recording sessions with Ozzie Cheeseman's radio orchestra.
Right.
And that was very well paid professional work and great musical training as well.
And so were you doing what is now the equivalent of a degree in performance at the university?
Yeah, that's right. I did three. It was actually, back then it was a 4-year degree. I actually stopped after 3 years and didn't finish it, because I got a job in the Auckland Sinfonia under Juan Matauchi.
Right.
And clarinet jobs are very hard to come by in this country, and when I succeeded the audition, for me it was a no-brainer to actually take the job, and which was full time at that stage.
Yes.
And so had to stop the degree. I came back to my degree in about 2001 and finished it. I was one paper short.
Right.
So finally got a degree to my name.
And when you set out, of course, at the age of, 13 on the clarinet, did you have any idea of the road it might eventually take you on, or were you just into playing?
I just enjoyed it. I didn't have any aspirations necessarily that I'm going to make my living at this. In fact, I don't even remember thinking about that. I just like doing it.
Right.
And of course, nothing can stop you from just doing it, because all you need is the clarinet and some reasonable health, and away you go. And it's just, I just absolutely love making the sound.
And I suppose the other thing about a woodwind instrument is that you often have to be in the company of other musicians. It brings you into ensembles, whereas an instrument like the piano can isolate you quite a lot.
Yeah, the best music for the clarinet is with ensembles.
Mm.
Chamber music and the ultimate actually is orchestral music, because that's the biggest body of repertoire.
Mm. What about playing jazz on it? Were you early acquainted with its jazz sort of coverage?
No, I've never taken to jazz. It's partly because I'm a bit of a talent-free zone in terms of jazz. It's not been my area. I've done a lot of work with improvisation, but not in the discipline of jazz.
Right.
It just hasn't gelled. It hasn't been my forte, as it were. I've been to a lot of jazz performances that I think I really kind of admire the process and the ability to come together and for a group of musicians, and all they have in common is the fact they know those tunes and they can sit down straight away and wait. There it all is, and a really engaging performance can happen. Mm. It's a very different thing to the classical world.
Yes, although I suppose to some degree that used to be in the classical world back in the 18th century, but it's tended to fade out.
Improvisation, yeah.
Was it the nature of the classical repertoire, or was the nature of the classical repertoire for clarinet a factor in attracting you to it, or was it, as you said, principally the sound?
Initially, it was just making the noise, actually. Yeah. That's entirely... and then slowly the interest in... and it was a kind of awakening of a musical interest in what... And then the link from making the sound then to the construction of phrases, and then to larger compositions...
Right.
And in a kind of an awakening of music in its wider context and in its more substantial forms.
And so when you began playing in what was then the Auckland Symphonia, do you remember what year that was roughly?
79.
Right. Because they went through a lot of difficult times financially, didn't they?
Yes, I remember 70s. Having got the job, and then within a year the orchestra had collapsed, and it was in financial ruin, and then I was part of the group that formed the new orchestra, which was then called the Auckland Regional Orchestra.
That's right.
And then by name change, it just became the Auckland Philharmonia Orchestra, which is the current incarnation.
And that was the time at which people like Ray Hope and...
Ray Hope and Janice Forsyth.
Yeah, and Janice Forsyth were playing with
it. Brecken Carter, and some of them are still there. John Ewer.
Yes.
Excellent man. Fountain of knowledge and experience. We formed the Auckland Regional Orchestra, and as a players' collective run by the players... Who, you know, the governing body was the players.
Mm. Is that still the status quo with the Philharmonia?
No, it's changed now. It's become a management run board at the top structure. I'm not part of it now, so I understand that's the new look.
Before your 20th year, were you based solely in New Zealand, or did you happen to live in any other countries? Or
New Zealand, no living overseas at all at that point. And I was, as I said, I was at the Auckland Grammar Boarding School, which was a great experience, actually. Made some good friends there. And also gave one lots of time for practice, because there's that sort of rule of thumb, 10,000 hours makes the musician.
Yes, 10,000 hours.
10,000 hours, that's the magic number. And I ticked off a lot of those hours after school, because there wasn't much else to do except either run around with a rugby ball or hang out or play the clarinet, and I chose the clarinet.
Right. Now, I may be wrong here, but this is a memory of mine. There was a group in Auckland called Diggory, is it?
That's right, yeah.
Have I got that right? And your brother, Jeff, was a leading figure in it. And were you in the group?
Yeah, that. Yep,
yeah, I thought you were, but I was unsure.
Yeah, it was a group specialising in Renaissance and medieval music.
Right.
And it was the beginning of that whole revival of performing early music on original instruments.
Right.
And I played recorders and crumb horns and Rausch fifes and such instruments in that group.
How different were they from a modern clarinet?
Very different. I mean, recorder was another. I studied that concurrently with the clarinet with Steve Rosenberg, who was American-based, American-born virtuoso player who was living in New Zealand at the time. And, we toured, we played at folk festivals, we played at Nambassa, a rock concert, rock festival. In one sense, I guess it was a early kind of WOMAD type of group.
Yes.
We could have been in that kind of environment. We also played small house concerts. We did televised performance. And it was all medieval Renaissance music. And the instrumental lineup's interesting, because we had two VL players, which are like violins, but tuned and open tuning. With a very flat bridge, so most of the strings would vibrate all the time.
Right.
You sometimes see those Renaissance paintings of medieval paintings with angels playing violins, what look like violins. Well, they're actually VLs. And we had some instrument makers make us copies. And they were the kind of core of the sound. And then we had my brother playing oud, which is a Turkish lute.
Yes, that's right.
Which is an instrument that goes way, way back and is, in fact, the ancestor of the lute.
Yes, there's been a program on it recently on Radio New Zealand.
It's a fantastic sound. Mm. And then we had the viol, which is one of the ancestors of the double bass, and then very percussion-based and some very fine, a very fine singer, Graham Dello.
Right. And how long was the group active for?
Oh, I think we were going for about 3 or 4 years.
Mm. And you were doing that as well as doing orchestral playing, were you?
Yeah, fitted it in around, because in those early days of the Auckland Regional Orchestra, the schedule wasn't very busy because we'd had to start it again. And so I remember the first year's work was kind of about a third of what it had been when it was full time.
Right. Were you aware of a body of New Zealand music or local composers who made particular use of the clarinet?
That came to me at Auckland University when I was studying with Ken Wilson, that horizons open beyond the Mozart Clarinet Quintet to the fact that there were composers, New Zealand composers, because high school music syllabus didn't cover them
at
all at that stage. And so it was when university studies, and there I remember classes with John Rimmer. I didn't actually take composition, but we did some simple composition work in a paper called Materials of Music, which was designed to be a kind of eye-opener or ear-opener to more possibilities than we were accustomed to. And he was a great, great, very inspiring lecturer, and And I remember he sent us out to Albert Park to score down and notate the sounds around us, a kind of music experiment. And then we wrote a piece based on that. And then, of course, at university, it was a lot of contemporary music ensembles and a lot of New Zealand music with the two lecturers that were there at that time, with John Elmsley and John Rimmer.
So I don't know if you find it a problem with your pupils now, but I still find it a problem with piano pupils that most of them, until I tell them, have no conception that there is New Zealand music.
Mm.
And then I usually try and get them to play some. But there's a big blank out there in regard to composition in the world in general, I think, in the matter of New Zealand music. Now, Avant Garage, am I right in saying that you were involved in Avant Garage?
That's correct.
Yes, because again, it's sort of hazy in my memory. I saw them perform and I thought I saw you there.
Yeah, that was a government-funded called PEP scheme. It's like an employment project.
Right.
So instead of putting people on the dole, they you could, if you're registered unemployed, which we all were at that stage, because like I said, the orchestra had collapsed and so it wasn't full-time. And if you came up with a good project, then the government would pay the wages for you to execute that project. It was very enlightened thinking. And so the scheme that various people got together, I think Ivan was the director of it, was to form a group which combined classical with rock musicians, and that we would spend 3 months writing, and we had a studio and a manager and all sorts of stuff, and then 3 months touring.
Right.
And also in that package was recording. We released an LP and a few cassettes. And then 6 month period ended, and then that was the end of that scheme. I think the government shut it down. Perhaps there was people abusing it, I'm not sure. I think it's one of those situations. But that was a lineup with Ivan Zani was the director of the group.
Mm.
And we had Tim Mann, bass player from Blam Blam Blam. We had Wayne Laird, who was timpanist with the APO, Mandy Hollins, flute player, Pam Gray on cello, Mark McEwen, bassoon.
Yes.
And Ben Staples, who was a radical kind of punk percussionist, as percussionist. And one more, Mike Kahn, who's Blind Date and Street Talk.
No, I remember it having a lot of energy when I am I right again with my memory in saying that you did a performance at Lim's studio?
That's correct.
In Ponsonby, yes.
Yeah, I think we did a season. That was our rehearsal space.
Yeah.
We had a studio there and then would perform in the main dance area.
Right. Could you call it a kind of, to use a trendy modern term, could you call it fusion music?
Yeah, it was the classical musicians connecting in with rock, the rock players. One of the ways it had flexibility and was a very interesting sound was that we didn't have a drummer as such. It was a percussionist, so there wasn't any drum kit. And that was a thing that Ivan had set up right from the start, that the group, there wouldn't be a drum kit. It would just would be bass-driven with percussion. So it kept it lighter, and so that way the classical side of it could kind of express itself, could link in with the electric guitars and bass guitar.
Right, well, that's an interesting way of doing it, isn't it?
Yeah, it made the forces balanced.
Yes.
Because drums can completely dominate.
Now, you said you spent 3 months writing music, but to what degree were the performances semi-improvised? I had the impression there was quite a lot of improvisation happening.
In the first performances that we were doing before we had a full repertoire, a lot of improvisation, sort of basic outlines and structures we'd devise, and then they were very the execution of them was an improvisation. But as we got further and further through the 6 months, everybody had written one or two pieces or songs, depending on what you want to call them, And so the set, as it were, ended up being a totally structured.
Right.
And a few moments for improvisation in there, but mostly it was fully scored music.
How do you find improvisation on the clarinet? I think I have seen you improvising solo on the clarinet in a concert at the university, but I'm unsure to what degree.
My work with improvisation is, I had a group called The Big Eye. I had a brief residency at Auckland University, and during that residency formed a group called The Big Eye, as in Little Eye with a dot on the top. It was a mixture of mostly classical musicians and it was classical musicians, my friends and colleagues who were interested in. We had would meet regularly and just improvise and then come up with plans and structures for improvisation. And of course the scale from improvising through to strictly notated composition is, for me, is a seamless spectrum.
Right.
Because Schoenberg himself said composition is just slowed down improvisation. And so there's no, you know, it's not like there's improvisation over here and there's composition over here. They're actually completely connected, because in both senses you're just making it up.
That's right.
Whether you're composing a totally scored out symphony or whether you're improvising completely freely, you know, both structures have been made up by the creator.
Mm.
It's just the composition process is slower, and it's set in concrete.
Yeah.
So that you know, not eliminating the kind of piece where performers can make decisions, and so every performance can be different. But generally, composition, you can tell straight away what the piece is going to be. Whereas with improvising, it's something completely different every time.
Did you improvise much with Ivan in any, you know, just the two of you?
Yeah, a lot of our pieces were would be just like that. A lot of pieces I wrote and worked with Ivan, because we were both composers and we both wrote for each other. But we had one called "Who's There," which we played on Mike Knox's jazz program once, which we were guests for that TV show. And that began life on tour, where we just decided, okay, let's go out there, and this is going to be an improvised this piece. But what we did, we just said, right, here's three notes. Bim, bum, bum. And so that's the beginning of the piece, had just those three pitches. We both played them in unison and then improvised.
Right.
And then the second performance, we added a little more. We added like another little phrase to it. And so we went out and played that, and then the second phrase, and then improvised. And by the end of the tour, there was quite an extended, worked out composition that began the whole piece before the improvisation process started. So it was kind of like improvisation and composition working
in combination,
as you know, as we played it virtually.
So Ivan taught me the little I ever learned about improvisation with him on the guitar and me on the piano. I found him very good.
Yeah, he's inspiring. He's
very good.
In fact, I remember Ivan telling me a story about him, because he played rock and he played jazz. And he was at some club on his guitar, and it was a some combo, and Ivan was soloing away, and then someone next door to someone who was sitting at a table like right just there said, "He's just making it up."
That's right.
And, exactly right. You got it right on the button there.
No, I can remember watching him just take off on the guitar. It was tremendous.
Yeah, we had a
scene playing like that on the guitar.
I had Ivan was a guest and one of the composers for the Gone to the Beach concerts with the ACO recently, and one of his piece that he wrote for that project had him playing this big semi-acoustic guitar, which he would play with a bow.
Yes,
and
right.
His whole performance began with this extended, improvised solo for bowed, and it was, and the sounds that he was getting out of it was just incredible.
What about the overall musical environment in Auckland through this period of the 70s and early 80s? Any comments? As you were becoming fully engaged in it all, was it a user-friendly environment for you, or was it a struggle? Or?
Well, I was coming at it from the point of view of being a clarinetist in the classical world mostly, and then with these other projects kind of intersecting with other art forms. And I mean, I was busy as hell doing all the stuff.
Didn't have time to worry.
And it didn't even, the whole concept of where the audiences are coming and relevance and all of that, it all just those questions never arose. We were doing concerts and people were turning up and straight on to the next project. Everything was dovetailing into the next work, and it's really, really, very exciting.
This is, again, this general period is the time of the emergence of the postmodern, in the arts. And I suppose in some sense it was a freeing up after the rigidity and austerity of high modernism. To what degree throughout that time, again, as a student and as somebody going, embarking on a career in music, to what degree did those concepts cut any ice with you? Were you much moved by them in any direction? Or?
Well, I think the fusion that was avant-garde was part of that, the arts sort of starting to mix with each other and influence each other. Music's always followed behind those kind of movements in modern, in visual arts and other mediums. Music tends to sort of drag its feet a little bit, and because it takes a while for audience to follow. And and the thing too, when I was immersed in music, that the current trend is not necessarily as relevant as the entire history of it.
No.
Is what I found, because I found myself being fascinated by medieval sounds and the open tunings and the drones and all that stuff, being really excited by that kind of music, as well as playing Lyle Cresswell. I'm just trying to think of the early first playing... Stravinsky and Bartok, and for me it's just like it's like the past is of equal relevance as to what's the current trends are.
Yeah, there's a famous saying in evolution about it. It's called the presence of the past.
Yeah, it rings true.
Mm. You maintained for a long time this zigzagging around through various periods and picking what particularly interested you out of them.
Yeah, and part of that was obviously clarinet driven in the early days, but then as I got more involved in ensembles and conducting, then I wasn't restricted to things that only had the clarinet in them. and combining the improvisation work with composition, those two things played off each other. And in fact, what slowly happened since then is that I do less improvising now. I've kind of and find it more productive and should I say relevant to actually get it down on paper. because a lot of times with just, especially with very free improvising, you're covering it the same ground over and over again, and I don't see the point in that. I see the need to kind of let the ideas and the material develop into something that's a bit more unique.
At what point did you begin to see yourself particularly as a composer?
Oh, I think, the avant-garde started all that.
Right. And by that time, you were already well aware of a body of New Zealand composition. So did that help give you a basis, do you think?
I think the basis is that it's just that it showed it as something that people did, and
yes.
And it was an ever increasing body of composers that was becoming apparent. I mean, from the early days of New Zealand composition through to seeing colleagues and students and people just writing music, and it was like a massive renaissance.
Mm. And I guess at that time, of course, a lot of the earlier generation of the 30s and 40s were still active 30 years ago, weren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. David Farquhar and Douglas Lilburn, of course, was alive then, but although he wasn't actually writing for the instruments anymore, his output had slowed down from that.
Did you ever feel in composing that there was a particular, shall we say, New Zealand inflection to composition, a kind of nationalist colour or quality? I mean, Lilburn is the obvious example, but how far did that spread around the compositional circles?
If I can just jump forward to a concert that I did recently, I brought a number of sort of new generation New Zealand composers, Robin Twan, Carlo Magetic, Sam Holloway, and Anthony Young, and I brought these composers together in one concert. And having gone through the rehearsal process with all those composers, and I remember talking to the audience before the program and saying that there isn't a New Zealand sound, because you've got four composers here. Oh, that was right. Chris Kendall was the other one. And they are all making such incredibly different sounds, completely different harmonic approaches to harmony and dissonance and rhythm and everything. There's not a unifying factor in them, unless we can't see the woods for the trees, as the saying goes. But and I think that's what's happened. I think that composition in New Zealand is incredibly influenced by international happenings, by world music, by there's a lot that's being influenced by Māori music, and bringing in tangapura into their scoring, but it does not make for a unique New Zealandness. I haven't heard a unique New Zealandness. I think Lilburn's been stamped with that because it was like he was the only guy doing it, virtually. And so this body of symphonic work with all its lovely long string sounds, and then you think of it as landscape and New Zealand and things. But personally, I don't hear that. I can attach it to it because I know it comes from New Zealand. But I don't hear it intrinsically in the music itself. I think it's still abstract
yes.
music.
It's very hard for music to take up an association with a particular landscape because of the nature of it, isn't it?
Yeah. You can hear Caribbean rhythms being used, and that's Caribbean culture in the music, and so you hear that. And that's the influence of that. That's very strong. You can hear blues. If some classical composer takes blues and is inspired by that, then that has a root, that's the originates in American blues. so it is of that country, But I'm yet to hear a sound or a style of composition that I go, yeah, that's New Zealand music. I think it's too diverse. We're too influenced now by forces.
Well, it's become incredibly eclectic. But I suppose in Lilburn's generation, he was part of a very small group of painters and writers and poets who were trying to find a place here. And so that might, if there was such a moment, that was when it was happening, rather than in recent years.
I think too, the grouping of composers into national groups, it depersonalizes them, because you're talking, it's art, and it's the individual expression of the individual person that is what the art is. It's not the fact that they're in a body of other composers or who will come from the same country.
Right.
That's my feelings about that. You know, you have American composers, you have your Copland and Bernstein, and it's an artifice that groups them together. I think they're individual people. And when the grouping, when you see often the groupings that come, the groupings are made, you know, this national awareness, this national sound, by picking out particular pieces from those composers and grouping it with another particular piece from another composer. And so you see a likeness of sound or style, and therefore that becomes like the sound of that country. But when you look at someone like Copland, I mean, the great depth of differences of style of music that he writes. For that one that sounds really American, like Appalachian Spring, you can get the piano sonata or...
It's much more abstract.
And it's way more abstract and doesn't have any of that stuff in it. so I think some of those, that kind of groupings for me is those kind of groupings are artificial and contrived. I think composers look to the world, look to the, you know, are influenced by many, many things.
And I guess that's more true now than ever before, because the communication is so easy.
Yeah, and you can go to any part of the world online now and see what it sounds like, what they're doing there.
A lot of your compositional activity has involved collaboration with other arts or, you know, being a multimedia process. Do you find that particularly rewarding, that kind of...
It's challenging. It's challenging. The best thing about it is that it forces you to a deadline, and you've got to get something done, and you've got to get it shipped. You know, you've got to finish it, because generally with a collaboration, there's always a deadline, And whereas when you're writing a piece purely for your own, because you want to write it, you can get into that space of it's never finished. You know, you're always tweaking it forever. So yeah. Collaborations with film, writing film scores, working with the film director. That's the main collaboration there. And that's is always completely different depending on who the director is.
There'd be a lot of pulling you into a particular line when you were writing for a film, I'm presuming.
Yes, there's often, it does depend on the director. So some of them are very happy to touch up and make suggestions, and then in other situations it's no, don't like that, do another one. And do that cue again, and possibly again, until it starts heading in the direction.
You've done a lot of film scores.
A few.
Is that because you particularly like that process?
I do like it. I like it because it is a challenge, and you are having to sort of second your... You're working for another art form, basically, or you're part of a larger art form, which is the film. And music's one ingredient in it. It's an incredibly important ingredient. Of course, that depends on the film, but the films that I've done, music's always been a big, big part of it, especially Memory and Desire, the Nicky Caro's first feature film.
Right.
And there was so little dialogue in it. It was all about music.
Right.
big, long, extended sequences with nothing said, just looks and a few words now and again. And so the whole sound of the film became very music-driven.
In a way, the music became the narrative, or a strong part of the narrative. Because I was going to ask you, you know, how you make that relationship between films, which usually are very narrative-driven, and the structure of music, the processes of composing.
Yeah, if the film is dialogue heavy, then the music has to fall into the background, and as a composer, you can't be too frustrated by that. And the more in the background that the music has to go, the more one-dimensional it has to be. Because if the front of the mix is the dialogue and then the music's got to sit behind that, well, then there's very little chance for any depth of, you know, foreground and background in the music. It just has to be one thing, one level. And that has its own challenges and difficulties.
Do you have a film score that you think is, you know, the one you like best or most successful? Or
The one that just leapt into my mind was No Country for Old Men, which I don't think has got any music in it at all.
I meant rather one of your own.
Oh, one of my own ones. Memory and Desire, I think, is one of the best I did. But all the scores I've done, there's something about each of them that's very unique. Like Desperate Remedies was just so in your face and a chance to be, you know, completely overblown with the music, because that was the nature of the film, with all the costume and the drama and the, and then Memory and Desire, which is a very human story, and because of the dialogue thing, and then the 50 Ways of Saying Fabulous, that was another. In a way, that was one of the most difficult films I've done, trying to make the music work for that, because of the delicacy of it. Very delicate story. And the one of the last I did was The Tattooist, which is what I've been wanting to do for ages, which is do a horror film.
Right.
So it was about a demon who goes around tattooing people to death. And it was lots of great opportunities for music to pick up on the sound of the someone tattooing, and the tick 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 tick,
yes,
tick tick with those tools that.
That's an interesting dimension to music, isn't it?
And I'm desperate to do a sci-fi. Mm. I want to do a sci-fi film.
Right. And can you speak of some of the highlights or notable experiences as a soloist over the years?
Yeah, the first big solo break I had was actually with the Auckland Youth Orchestra on Australian tour.
Yeah.
And played this quite obscure clarinet concerto that I'd fallen in love with at the time by Bernhard Crusell. 19th century composer, Finnish, I think. That got me really hooked on that medium, standing in front of an orchestra and playing the concerto form. That followed on doing Mozart and Copland, Nielsen, Stamitz, other important clarinet concertos. Mozart with the NZSO, actually Mozart with most of the orchestras in New Zealand.
Yes, I think I've heard you playing Mozart.
And yeah, I've played it. Mm-hmm. You don't get tired of that piece. It's a pretty...
In fact, I might have heard you play it more than once.
Yeah, it's in the top sort of 100, top... In fact, it might even be in the top 10 of some of the classic favourites of all time, that these statistics that come out. It's a pretty fabulous piece.
Yeah, it is.
Very late Mozart.
Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time. You have performed on that, haven't you?
Messiaen, yes. I've played that... in fact, my first one of my first major professional chamber music gigs was with a group called the Auckland Chamber Music Players, put together by Janetta McStay, the Auckland pianist. Was professor of piano at Auckland Uni till little while ago when she retired. And we toured that piece, the Messiaen, around the country, and it sure is. It's one of those masterworks, icons of 20th century music, written while he was in a prisoner of war camp, and very, very beautiful piece to play, technically challenging and emotionally and spiritually exhausting, should I say, or devastating or uplifting all at once.
Would I be right in saying that it's a key mid-20th century work that just refers forward and back?
Yeah, it's timeless and it's...
Would it be possible as a composer to avoid being influenced by it?
Messiaen, I think, has influenced most composers that are alive today.
Yeah, he's phenomenal, isn't he?
I think it's an extraordinary mind, and all his music. I've just recently bought a CD set of all his organ music, which is incredibly intense listening. But it's fascinating to see the way he has the link between all that repertoire and all his other composition. It's like everything comes from the organ, and there's big blocks of sound, and it really rings true to all his orchestral and chamber music.
Now, at the moment, a lot of your public activity is conducting. Well, that's how the world sees you, I suppose, at the moment. Would you like to describe how you took up conducting?
The first conducting experience that I had actually was kind of like the deep end. Actually, it was Lou Harrison's concerto for percussion and violin, percussion orchestra with solo violin, and it's, you know, metrically quite challenging. And conducting percussion is always challenging too, because of the need for absolute clarity, because percussion, the sounds are so immediate. It was kind of like in the deep end, and then go off and do some study and lessons and things. It was mid-80s, I think, and you know, because when you're developing in, as a musician and teaching and studying scores, it's just very natural to be sitting there and to be working with conducting gestures. One of the things I've said to my students often is it's really important to visualize and hear the music and vocalize it or whatever, and conduct at the same time, and not play. Just work through this, even if it's a solo clarinet piece, to just get the gesture of it and the flow of the physicality of it. And so for me, it was a very natural transition to then get in front of some musicians and start conducting. I also did in those years the Schoenberg Wind Quintet, conducted that, and then followed by Soldier's Tale. So it's all quite big stuff that required a lot of carefully working out technique and things like that.
Very complex scores.
And then my own compositions, I remember writing a symphony for Nelson Chamber Orchestra. Nelson Symphony Orchestra, actually, an amateur group, and I was conducting a concert and I wrote a piece for them. So it was a connection between that and then writing some music for the APO for design. The first one of them was a piece for orchestra and actors, and it was a theatrical piece with the orchestra on one half of the stage and a set, kind of a cartoon cutout set, with these bank robbers and young kids learning the violin and the young kids foiling the bank robbing heist and all this. It was written by Stephen Ballantyne. He wrote the play. And it was orchestra soundtrack to the whole play. So it was an integration between the orchestra and the actors. And then also another one by Margaret Mahe, The Clown's Birthday. And then a piece by with orchestra and narrator with words by Witi Himaira. And all of those works I conducted.
Mm.
And it was it was just, it's a natural transition from studying scores, music opening up with the clarinet, and then wanting to see what else is going on in the world of music and that's got nothing to do with the clarinet. And,
yes.
And so conducting was the path I took. Mm.
So we could say you evolved into conducting. Possibly you just...
Yeah, it's a kind of a bug, really. Mm. It's like it's a bit viral the way conducting gets hold of people.
When did you begin studying with Juan Matteucci?
Yeah, I worked with him over about a year.
Mm.
Had a few lessons, you know, very sporadic, but he was quite influential because he made his mark in New Zealand for his conducting, you know, firstly with the NZSO and then later with the Auckland Sinfonia. He had a wonderful sense of the epic nature of music and its romantic, you know, the romantic, the true expression of music. Mm. He wasn't a technician in a sense, but his ability to convey on a very deep emotional level was quite extraordinary. I did a lot of operas with him. I played clarinet.
Mm. He did specialise to some degree in conducting opera, didn't he?
He was conductor for most of the Mercury opera days with Raymond Hawthorne and directing and Juan conducting.
Right. I have very clear memories of him as a conductor and of him giving some very moving performances. So would you say that you were, that you had an apprentice relationship with him, or
no,
was it more casual than
no,
that?
No, it was quite casual. I would go to his house and discuss discussions about the music and then work on gesture and beat and technique and then what you're trying to convey with the music.
Is conducting a recomposing of the music? The fact that you're not physically having to play it, does this give you a peculiar degree of freedom? You are interpreting it, yet you're not having to wrestle with an instrument at the same time. Does that give you a particular form of freedom, do you think?
Yes, it is. It's freedom, although you have to totally have in mind the nature of the instruments that you're conducting and the way they breathe, the way they articulate, the way they bow, the responsiveness of the instruments, the spatial dimension of the orchestra on the stage. You've got people further back and so they're hearing it very differently to the way you're hearing it. So all of that has to be brought in. And you've got to find the freedom within those constraints.
Mm.
You've got to be looking after all those things. As a conductor, I look at the score as a composer. I mean, when I'm conducting, the composer in me is searching the music for how to express it and why is it like this and why has he said that and why is that word there and why are those dynamics as they are. And why is that marking there? And it's the composer in me that's searching. And interestingly, when I'm composing, it's often the conductor in me that's driving it, because I'll be looking at what is the gesture here in my own work. What is the clock? What is the physical gesture that accompanies this particular idea I'm working out?
So the kind of relationship that Mahler had, where he was a great conductor and also a great composer, is a very natural one, is it? It's a
He's one of the supreme masters of linking of the two.
Mm.
It's often now you don't get people who do both. You know, I think that a lot of composers now don't have any performing whatsoever, and I think it's a loss actually. I think to not have your creative process connected to the physicality of performing can lead you down the some tricky paths.
Mm. You've worked hard as a conductor to get representation for local composers, mainly composers who are still alive and still working. Can you enlarge on your plans in this direction?
Yeah, with the Auckland Chamber Orchestra, over the last 4 or 5 years, we've had, since its beginning, we've played a lot of New Zealand music. We had New Zealand music in the very first year when it was quite a skeletal year, just 4 concerts, did work by John Rimmer. And then there's been New Zealand music most years, in fact all years except this year. But we've also done composer portrait concerts, which is a concert given entirely to one composer. And the composers that we've represented with those performances have been John Rimmer, Eve de Castro Robinson, Ross Harris, John Pasathis, Gillian Whitehead, and also we did the Wax Lyrical program was one where there was 4 younger up and coming composers represented. So that they've been like retrospectives. They haven't involved commissions. They've been retrospective looks at these particular composers with a whole bunch of repertoire, which I'll go through their catalogue and discuss with the composer which works would be the best. And they've been very enlightening because in all the situations, the diversity and the variety of stuff that they've written, it makes for an incredibly interesting and engaging concert.
Mm. And
Gareth Farr was another one. The names will keep coming back to me.
Christopher Blake.
We did, although that actually wasn't perceived of as a composer portrait as such. That concert had its genesis as in the fact that he's written these 4 amazing string works, which are unified by the Robin Morrison photographs that they're based on.
Angel at Ahipara.
He's called the group of 4 pieces the Northland Panels. Mm. But each of them is based on a specific Robin Morrison photograph from the collection A Journey. I had to track down and find a copy of that book when we were doing that piece. When we performed it, we had the Robin Morrison photos projected onto the back wall behind the orchestra. So in a sense, the orchestra took secondary importance. The orchestra was in black and had sconce lights, so they it was quite hazy, and the photographs just, in a sense, dominated the visuals.
Mm.
But that's how that music's intended, because it is inspired totally by those photographs and Chris's journey through, in a sense, a parallel journey that he's made through Northland, following in Robin Morrison's footsteps.
And do you think that the situation for composition here is getting better? Is it getting easier to get audiences for it? Is it getting easier to get support for performances and all that sort of thing?
Well, all of those things, it's we're at a bit of a crossroads, potentially a crisis, actually, because I talk about in all this in New Zealand in contemporary music that it's really important that the stakeholders come. They're the people who are, you know, the composers and the performers and all the people that have a kind of a vested interest in the art form developing and working. and often they don't come to the concerts. And we sell appallingly small number of tickets to a particular New Zealand music program. So it doesn't quench my desire to do it. At sort of orchestra management levels, board levels, they question it because if people aren't coming, why are we doing it? But I believe in doing it because
of it.
Well, it's like, well, you know, it's because it's there and it's our stuff.
Mm.
And it just needs the attendance. I was watching Shostakovich documentary just recently. Someone met me. And here you have these amazing symphonies being played and the place just completely packed. Now, that might have been something to do with the fact that Stalin might have been in the audience, and if he didn't go, you're in big trouble. But it's a tricky situation. We're at a chicken and egg problem, because if we don't market the concerts, people don't come. But then the actual audience that's there for the stuff, my feeling is that they don't even look at, they're not, those people don't go trawling the newspaper looking for what to go to anyway.
Mm.
I believe that actually everyone knows we're doing these concerts. Everyone that's got an interest and a stakeholder in it and who are interested in the music and who believe in it and all that stuff, they actually know we're doing it.
Mm.
But they're not coming. And it's scary.
At the moment, you're conducting the Auckland Chamber Orchestra, which I suppose is sufficiently, would it be true to say that a smaller orchestra perhaps gives you a bit of flexibility to program
for
works that aren't necessarily very popular?
Yeah, we it's a smaller group, and also we can kind of morph from just being a quintet or a sextet right up to a 30-piece orchestra, which gives us a lot of programming flexibility, and it makes for very colourful concerts too, because you get the extraordinary variety of mixes of instruments and stuff like that.
And that would be useful in representing local composers, would it?
Yeah. That's been the nature of the composer portrait concerts we've done, that... You know, from I think in Gareth Farr's concert, we had a duo did the Kembang Suling, you know, the piece for flute and marimba, and then in the same program we had a full string orchestra playing an adaptation of his one of his string quartets.
Well, when you go to go back to the issues of conducting, what are the differences between conducting small, more mobile ensembles like the chamber orchestra and conducting a big symphony orchestra? Is there an essential difference, or?
The big thing is inertia.
Inertia.
Yeah, it's like when you're conducting the largest group I've ever conducted is 110 or so LPO musicians in George Martin's Air Studios in London.
London Philharmonic.
Yeah, the London Philharmonic, and and the smallest I've conducted is a string quartet. I think that's the smallest, and it's an inertia thing. It's this feeling of getting the sound going.
Yeah,
whereas with a string quartet, it's like ping and it goes, whereas it's just whoom. It's just like you can get it moving. It's like, you know, on a flat railway track, you could push a multi megaton carriage, and humanly it is possible to get it going if it's flat. It's just this inertia that you have to work with, and it's a different. So there's different kinds of techniques, and a different responsiveness actually is a big part of it. The sense of responsiveness of your gesture and the input, the sound that comes back from that. It's about lag and time delay and all that kind of stuff.
Right. So I guess a smaller group is the more nimble.
Yeah, it is. It's not so spread out. You see, that's the other thing too, is that when you've got a 100-piece symphony orchestra, there's about, there could be 20, 30, 20 metres between from one musician to another musician, from one end of the strings to the other, or from the forward to the back. Mm. And that has its own acoustic problems in terms of only milliseconds, but it's enough of delay to make it, to make the ensemble process very dependent on the conductor.
Right.
Whereas with a small group, like for example, when I conducted Shostakovich String Quartet with the singer, I had to conduct because they couldn't play it without conductor because the singer was many meters upstage.
Right.
Away from the quartet, and so there was no direct communication. But the instantaneous nature of their response is very different to a large group.
And with the European orchestras you've conducted, like the London Philharmonic and the Prague Symphony, what were you working on with them?
And with those concerts, with those recordings, they were in the category of crossover, because the music was symphonic adaptions of music by The Doors, Led right. Zeppelin, Pink Floyd.
Mm.
So they weren't they weren't the type of project you have, like for example Metallica with the LA Philharmonic, that thing where you have the band and the orchestra in the background. Kind of, you don't hear much of the orchestra. The things that I was working on were purely symphonic. There was no band there.
Right.
They were symphonic adaptions of the music that the band had written. And the Doors Concerto was really interesting because with Nigel Kennedy playing a solo violin part, the whole thing was arranged and conceived of as a big violin concerto. And Nigel Kennedy was soloist, and it's the hearing the Ray Manzarek solos, keyboard solos, and things was quite extraordinary.
Your present programming of the ACO, do you have a fair degree of autonomy with that, you and the players?
Totally. Make the program choices. I don't think you can program via committee. I've seen it happen, and I think it becomes it dilutes it. And what holds a program together is a thread of one person's idea. And I think that when you have a committee trying to choose pieces, it just becomes it's like imagine trying to do a painting with one particular painting with three artists or four artists, or write a poem collectively. And the programming has a similar subtlety of connecting a few pieces together, and you have to totally believe in it yourself for it to be able to then present it. So anyway, what happens with the ACO is I make the programs and choose the pieces, and in the context of the composer portrait programs, I'll work with the composer on it, because they'll have an input and make suggestions and say, no, don't do that, how about this piece, and I'll go, sure, but there you have the artist, the composer artist making. You know, who knows his music better than I know it, and so their actual input's really, really incredibly valued in that context.
You often had a relationship with words, just want to ask, did the words suggest particular musical shapes, or is the connection less direct? For instance, when you said a part of a poem by me, Walking into the Millennium.
The Birth of Light, yeah.
The Birth
yeah.
of Light. What does the word do to you that makes you turn it into music, so to speak, or to make that connection?
The first thing, of course, is the natural rhythm of the words.
Mm.
And so that's one hook into the how it's going to work in the end. And then the other one is the, I mean, then there's the various resonances and ambiences of the words themselves. And then that would affect the kind of instrumental colours that you throw in there. Then there's the pace of that's implied by the poem.
Right.
So it's all coming from the words, setting these fundamental principles of the kind of music that's going to go with it. I think trying to think back to the Birth of Light when I set your words. There's also then a point at which you sort of leave all that and just have that floating around in your subconscious, and I would then start developing instrumental textures and processes and lines and melodies and rhythms and things, and then referencing them back and then moving until the thing starts to take shape.
What about writing for dance, which you've also done quite a lot of?
Yeah, my big dance project was Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes.
I got a commission to do another Midsummer Night's Dream, which, of course, Mendelssohn had already tackled that one quite well. But the Royal New Zealand Ballet wanted a fresh look, and so I got the commission to write a completely new Midsummer Night's Dream. Same Shakespearean story, but with a contemporary score. And it was for a small ensemble of string quartet, it was the New Zealand string quartet, with four saxophones, a group called Saxess, and two percussionists and a piano player. and so, yeah, writing for dance, I was working closely with the choreographer. But the process was of firstly mapping out the whole sequence of dances and the storytelling that was needed to be done. And then I was given, quite considerable license in terms of the kind of music I wrote. And the choreographer was incredibly able to just, whatever I sent for that particular scene, he said, "Great, love it." He choreographed it. Yeah.
He would take your music and make the shape from your music.
Yeah.
Right. So what about a work like The Islands, works that you did with Alison East? You wrote the music first.
The music came first, yes. And then she totally choreographed the music and didn't ask me to make any, structural changes or anything. She was amazing the way she could make the dance fit.
Mm.
And other dance, well, it's more in theatre, actually, I've written scores. And, of course, when you're writing for a movie, often it's quite balletic. 50 Ways of Saying Fabulous, the director, Stuart Main, it was very much about composing. There's one scene which was all about looks, just like looking as they eyeballed each other, and it went from eyeball to eyeball to eyeball, and the music had to line up with this whole little dance of the eyes.
Right.
In a very balletic way, actually.
Choreography for the glance.
Yeah, it was just eyeball, but...
I must say I didn't know until I read your CV that you'd also written some electronic music.
Yep, one of the Islands pieces was an electronic.
Was it purely electronic?
It was with clarinet, and then But the very electronic nature of the score is because the clarinet sound is going through some quite complex signal processing,
right?
To give it a another almost symphonic dimension to it,
right?
It's an art form that's been constantly evolving for quite some time. And now with softwares like Max, M-A-X, it's getting very, very sophisticated what can actually happen in that regard, where you have a live performer and signal processing that's happening in real time during the performance.
Mm. So do you think you'll work more in that field?
I'd really love to work more in that. But what I've found is that the pieces that I made with that all relied on technology that's kind of in a black box that you can adjust and program, and it's quite user-friendly. The current state with Max and other softwares like this is that it requires an incredible learning curve to learn the software and its ramifications and its possibilities. And I don't, you know, the books, there's about this much of manual, and I have it, and I'm chipping my way through that one to try and get better at it. But it's a virtuoso process in its own right.
Mm.
Actually, the mastery of the software,
mm.
you know, let's talk about the 10,000 hours again. It's almost at that level. Of complexity, the people that are extraordinary at it are spending all their time at it, and so it's been sidelined in my work a little bit at the moment. I see the possibilities, and I think the best way forward with that would be to collaborate with someone whose life is Max, and work with them creatively. It's a sort of technology, as I've finding with I work a lot with a software called Logic, which is an audio and a sequencing software and a notation software all bound up together, and I do a lot of my composing with that. It's manual. I don't know how thick it is. It's only online, but it's a huge book of reading to master that software. And what I find is that each time a new software turns up on my computer, I get more and more of this feeling of all these manuals that I have to read. And somehow there's an end to how much space there is in the brain for complex software. You start running out of, I don't know what it is. I think with it is that you have to actually, with any software, you have to be working with it, and you have to be constantly working with it. Mm. I don't know if that rings true to others, but if you leave something for a while and then come back to it, say 6 months later, there's all the stuff you've forgotten, and you've got to relearn it.
And so it starts to drive the project rather than you.
Yeah, it can become... Mm. And then, you know, I've just started reading the book about Dreamweaver, which is website development, and that's another 1,200-page manual to just begin to learn how to use it. And, you know, so I'm thinking, hang on, maybe it's a point of to slice that off and delegate it to people who are spending their lives with that particular product.
Yes, because some of those processes are not necessarily compositional processes as such.
No, they're about...
They're about managing the technology.
Yeah, and managing, you know, like websites and stuff is just about career admin and stuff like that. The other thing too is that when you've been working with computers for, you know, like I have since late 80s or something, I do remember the hours and hours and hours I spent on certain areas and certain software packages. That's all completely redundant now, completely obsolete.
Mm.
And none of those skills are transferable. So in a sense, it's a complete waste of time.
Pen and paper is at least transferable.
Yeah, yeah.
so what of the f- future, Peter? I mean, I would imagine with conducting, composing and playing, and I presume still doing some teaching, you don't lack for things to do.
No, there's plenty to do. The ACO and its programming is that's a huge challenge, because what I love about the ACO is that it just keeps me in touch with the whole international world of music composition that's happening, and also I'm getting to know a lot of New Zealand composers better, and discovering some great music, and our loyal audience seem to be going along with this journey and getting really positive feedback about that. It's tough times, of course, though, because in the country at the moment there's big reshuffle of orchestral funding, and I can't quite see how it's going to do us any good. I think it's a shrinking going on, sort of like what Radio New Zealand Concert's been going through, threats to its even existence.
Yes, yes, that is going on at the moment. But I suppose you can always compose, even if it takes a long time to get anything finally performed.
Yeah, nothing stops that.